From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on this show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. President Trump has named a respected military intellectual, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, as National Security Advisor. He replaces Michael Flynn, who was forced to resign. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson traveled to Mexico to try to improve relations in the wake of Trump's insistence on building a border wall and accelerated deportation of illegal aliens in the United States. A U.S.-led coalition made more headway removing the Islamic State from Iraq's second-largest city, Mosul. The Trump administration was still reviewing a variety of imperfect options to defeat the extremist group in Syria. And finally, the United Nations reported that 20 million people, more than a million of them children, are at risk of dying from famine. They are living mostly in Africa, but also in Yemen, a war-torn Middle Eastern country. Tom, we're going to start with General McMaster. He made quite a name for himself as a young officer with a really searing critique of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the general management of the Vietnam War. He wrote a book called Dereliction of Duty. I understand that you know him. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I don't know him well, but I do know him. We were fellows for a couple of weeks at Stanford University about 10 years ago, and I was struck by how smart he was. Some of your listeners know that I spent 22 years as an Army officer, active and reserve, mainly reserve. And so I understand the military culture pretty well. And McMaster struck me at the time that I knew him as a really smart guy, an intellectual, a fierce warrior. He wasn't just what some Army officers call a social scientist in uniform. He is, I would call him the real deal, a warrior social scientist in uniform. And he has pushed back at what he has thought from time to time has been the rigidity of the Army brass and the military brass, and it almost cost him getting promoted to general. He was passed over for general twice by promotion boards led by officers who thought he was a little too forward, a little too in your face. But during the George W. Bush administration, he was finally promoted to brigadier general, one star. And since then, he has gotten more and more interesting assignments, although the Army recently put out the word that they couldn't find a promotion for McMaster, so he should think about retiring later this year. Well, now he doesn't have to retire.
Yeah, you know, actually, I have a question about that. Was he obliged to take this job because he is an active duty military officer? Could he have said no? Because another candidate for the job, a retired Admiral Harwood, turned Trump down.
He could have said no, but it's always difficult when the commander-in-chief asks you to do something like this. But if you're McMaster and you know that the Army, which he loves, is forcing him to get out later this year, what better way to continue to serve your country? So I think it's wise of him to stay on active duty, which he can do. But I think McMaster is smart enough, he is tough enough to be an honest broker, which is basically what the National Security Advisor needs to be and what General Flynn was not expected to be doing a good job of. And so I think McMaster is a good choice, almost universally acknowledged as a good choice.
Yeah, Linda, this was a rare moment of bipartisan harmony in Washington. Democrats and Republicans praised the choice. We have a lot of active and ex-generals now running around the White House. The Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis. We have
John Kelly
at Department of Homeland Security. Now we've got an active general, H.R. McMaster. Trump seems to like generals, but I guess the question is whether these individuals can really have major influence, especially if they work together. And I would add into that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford. My understanding is that all of them work together at various times in Iraq or Afghanistan.
No, I think it's interesting that here's Donald Trump, who is, you know, the buck stops with him. He has surrounded himself with these generals who are professionals and who obviously have tons of experience. They know the world, and they can tell Donald Trump, they can't tell him what to do, but I think he will actually listen to them. He famously said during the campaign that he knew more than the generals, which was one of the many laugh lines out of Donald Trump. But he later amended that to mean, I disagree with Barack Obama's generals. So now he's got his generals. And I think now that Michael Flynn is out of the picture, a bit of a rogue and a, you know, made a lot of people nervous, we seem to have a solid core of generals advising the president. Now, if we were talking about another type of country, that might make some people nervous.
Yeah, sort of like a junta.
Exactly. But I think in this case, these men are all known quantities and respected in a bipartisan way, as you said. And it's actually nice to have moments of bipartisan happiness in Washington.
They're so rare. Yeah, you wanted to add something, Tom?
Below the radar, however, Barbara, and I agree with everything Linda just said, I think this is a good bunch of generals. But below the radar, there is some whispering that the NSC staff put together by General Flynn allegedly has too many generals and colonels. I mean, Flynn had surrounded himself with about half a dozen army officers, some of them retired, because he wanted to have a comfort zone with people he'd served with. And there is some feeling that you have to have more of a balance between civilian and military than General was going to have. It'll be interesting to see, since the White House has gone out of its way to say McMaster has full authority to hire and fire. It'll be interesting to see whether some of these Flynn colonels and generals will remain on the NSC.
Some of them worked with McMaster, too. I'm thinking of people like Joel Rayburn and Derek Harvey, who retired Army officers who served in Iraq.
Right.
So we'll see. But, Lyndon, there are many power centers in this White House, as we know, and you know, these generals maybe form one circle, but there's been a lot of discussion recently about something called Strategic Initiatives Group. And this is an organization that is run by Stephen Bannon. I'm told it deals with domestic issues as well as foreign policy issues, but it has some people in it like Sebastian Gorka and others who are known for very Islamophobic views, who have a conspiratorial view of the world, very much like General Flynn. So I guess the question is, will Trump allow the National Security Council to do its job, or will there be policies that will be developed by alternative power centers that suddenly, you know, emerge? And I think of the visa ban, the travel ban, which came out of Bannon and his shop.
Right. No, I think it's still early days in the Trump White House. It's still shaking out exactly how this is going to work. For example, Steve Bannon got himself appointed to the Principals Committee of the National Security Council.
Yeah, will he stay there? Yeah.
Will he stay there? Will he, as you suggest, continue to throw his weight around on national security issues, which is not his area of expertise, although he did serve in the Navy.
Yeah, 30 years ago.
30 years ago as a, you know, junior guy. Yeah, I think his appearance this week at the Conservative Political Action Committee, an important annual meeting of conservatives in Washington, was very significant. He's generally behind the scenes, and I think his decision to come out and speak for the cameras indicated his desire to perhaps reassure people, or in the case of people
or
who
intimidate people,
listen to what he said, reinforce the very strong message that he brings to the table about economic nationalism and about smashing the so-called administrative state.
Yeah.
I think that's his primary goal. I really don't see him injecting himself.
Micromanaging the war in Iraq or Syria.
I just don't see that.
Yeah. I wanted to turn now to another important cabinet official who actually hasn't gotten much attention, and that's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Tom. He went to Mexico. Actually, he went with John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security, to try to do some damage control, I guess is the best way to put it. It's kind of ironic that U.S. relations with Mexico, our close neighbor, are as poor as they are now since Trump came in. And I'm just wondering your impression of how well they did. I mean, there was some pushback against some of the things that Trump had said in the press conference that they gave and so on. How did they do?
Well, clearly President Trump is putting together a good cop, bad cop routine across the globe. He sends Vice President Pence and General Mattis to Munich for a security conference, and they say all the right things to reassure the very nervous Europeans about President Trump's commitment to NATO. Tillerson and General Kelly are sent to Mexico, and they're trying to spread a little bomb on troubled waters. I don't know how well they did. I think Trump is George W. Bush might say, has misunderestimated the anger in Mexico about being used as a piñata, to coin a poor, a bad metaphor there. But it's really interesting that there is going to be a presidential election in Mexico about 16 months from now. And if things don't get better here,
the far left candidate could win.
Exactly right, riding a wave of anger against President Trump. So I don't know. I think that the relations between Mexico and the United States have gotten very bad. They're probably going to get worse. Every time you have an administration official talk about a border tax to punish Mexico as a way to build the wall, it just sends Mexican politicians right up the wall. Another bad metaphor there, I suppose. But I think this is not going well. And while General Kelly and Secretary Tillerson, who's been a bit of a phantom, let's face it so far, are better interlocutors than, say, President Trump, I don't think the relationship between these two countries is looking very good right now.
Yeah, Linda, there are a number of factors at work. I should say there was a poll in Mexican newspaper that showed Trump had 3% popularity, by the way, which is...
Sounds kind of high to me.
which is interesting. I mean, this is a very complicated relationship. The U.S. gives a lot of aid to Mexico, but Mexico also buys $2 billion a year in U.S. corn, buys soybeans, wheat, cotton, and beef. There's so many issues here in terms of ways in which Mexico could hurt the United States, could reduce intelligence sharing, about mutual threats, the kinds of things that put into place after 9/11. It's with a lot of trepidation, I should think, that the U.S. approaches this. Plus, we have now this whole issue of deportations, of mass deportations, which is very troubling. But I'm going to take a break in one sec. We'll get back to that. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor, and joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. The orders have come down, an executive order, to find any illegal alien who has a criminal record and get rid of them. And this has really thrown a chill into the particularly Latin American community in the United States, yeah?
Right. No, and it isn't even just criminal records. It's now they put out guidelines sort of enhancing the executive order, which allow law enforcement to pick up even somebody with a traffic violation.
Right.
So you have a situation now with where you have churches who are setting up sanctuaries for undocumented people. People are hiding in their homes. There's great fear. And one of the risks in having a government putting this chill through the immigrant community is that they do not interact with law enforcement or, say, in the event of some kind of a medical situation. If somebody has an infectious disease and they're afraid to go to a hospital. I mean, it's just not good for society to have a population that is afraid and hiding and not interacting with the rest of the world.
Yeah. Tom, President Trump also had a mention about this being a quote-unquote military operation to eject people from this country. And then in Mexico, I think it was General Kelly had to push back on that and say, no, you know, the National Guard is not being mobilized for this purpose. And he also said that we're not talking about mass deportations. But, I mean, when the President of the United States uses rhetoric like that, people have a right to be quite nervous, yeah?
Well, and the White House press secretary quickly said he was using military as an adjective. It's President Trump's normal imprecision and exaggeration with words. I don't think the military is going to be involved, and I don't think there are going to be mass deportations, but however, it might be a distinction without a difference. It appears to me that there are going to be significant deportations, and they will go beyond what the stated purpose is to get rid of what Trump has called really bad dudes.
Right, dangerous criminals.
Dangerous people who have committed crimes, who are in jail. And I don't think most Americans would have a problem with deporting people like that, but I mean, then there becomes a gray area. Well, what about somebody who's been an upstanding citizen for 12 years and gets pulled in for speeding or driving under the influence of alcohol? Under these guidelines, that individual could be deported. And the whole notion that we're starting first with the really bad people who have committed crimes or are in jail or using drugs, all that means is we're going to go after them first, but who comes next? So it has set the Hispanic community on edge, as well as civil libertarians.
Yeah, yeah. I want to turn from the situation on our border now to the situation in the Middle East, Linda, and look at actually some good news for a change, which is coming out of Iraq. Of course, the group that calls itself the Islamic State took over Iraq's second largest city in 2014, and it has been a very, very slow process of trying to recapture Mosul. But Iraqi forces have now seized Mosul's airport, and it looks as though they are well on their way to recovering the western half of the city. The eastern half has already been retaken by an interesting coalition of American forces, Iraqi forces, and Shiite militias that are backed by Iran.
It's interesting, and I think the timing of H.R. McMaster's arrival in the White House is perfect in dealing with this. I mean, he wrote this book, Dereliction of Duty, based on his PhD thesis in the 1990s, which was all about how the United States lost the Vietnam War and how the war was not lost in the field or on the front pages of the New York Times or on college campuses, but in Washington, D.C., with the leaders. And this is a big test for President Trump and his advisors to handle this correctly. I mean, they're expected to stay with the strategy of relying on local proxies on the ground and not have a big surge in there. So Donald Trump's promises during the campaign that he was going to crush ISIS is, again, I think, one of those hyperbolic Trumpian statements that doesn't really reflect the reality on the ground.
Yeah. Tom, the recapture of Mosul would obviously be very important, but I was at an event recently with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joe Dumford, who said that they well understood that a military victory alone was not enough, that they would have to make sure that there was a political context for this, and that, in particular, Sunni Arabs in Iraq would feel that they have a place in this society. I've seen some reports that even after ISIS has been removed from various places, you know, that individual members kind of trickle back into places like Ramadi and Fallujah. Just curious what you make of the administration's efforts to review and rethink the Obama strategy toward ISIS.
Well, basically, the Trump administration's view on this is anything that Obama was for, we're against. I mean, they basically have been quite critical of President Obama's foreign policy generically, not just in the Arabs, between the Arabs and Israelis, but in Iraq, towards Iran, and towards Syria. And so I think the Trump administration is all about putting together a more robust, more muscular U.S. strategy, which involves more military
U.S. troops on the ground?
Exactly right, especially in Syria. I think that's coming. I mean, one of the first executive orders the new president signed was to task the government with coming up with a new strategy for defeating ISIS worldwide. The deadline is fast approaching for when that review is supposed to be completed. And so I believe you'll see more robust, more muscular U.S. involvement in Iraq, and I think military intervention of some undisclosed scale in Syria.
Now we have, Linda, I think we have about 5,000 troops in Iraq and about 500 special forces in Syria. And Syria presents an even more complicated picture. There was a report that Turkish-backed forces have reclaimed the town of El Beb from ISIS. And the Turks want to be the ones to liberate Raqqa, which is the capital of the caliphate. It's the center for ISIS in Syria. And the Obama administration had been working very closely with a force that was mostly made up of Syrian Kurds to try to take back Raqqa. And the Turks are at war with the Kurds, and so they want to be the ones. We pressed General Dunford on this, you know, would it be the Arabs? Would it be the Turks? Would it be the Kurds? Would we work with the Russians suddenly? And he said, well, we're preparing the options, he said. And we understand that each of these options has first and second and third order consequences, all this military speak, but he wouldn't really tip his hand. How do you think the administration is going to handle this? Because it wants a better relationship with Russia. It wants a better relationship with Turkey. But the Kurds have been the best fighters, really, certainly in Syria.
Right. That's a really tricky one. I mean, the Syria situation is probably the most bedeviling issue that faced Barack Obama. His entire presidency, he just didn't know what to do about Syria. He brought in a colleague of mine from the Monitor to talk to him about what to do. I mean,
really?
he would just bring in people and have these conversations and just sort of throw it open to just about anybody. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, famously backed away from the red line. So I'm not going to say that anybody can do, maybe the bar is low for President mm-hmm. Trump, that if they can pull something together better than the sort of non-action or the sort of tentative way that President Obama dealt with it, perhaps this could be some sort of success for President Trump. But the Russia question throws a huge X factor into this whole thing. I mean, Trump still seems very game to work with the Russians on areas of mutual interest, and this is certainly one of them. Of course, the Russians have done nothing to help in the crushing of ISIS. So, you know, if they can really work on something there, then maybe that's a positive.
General Dumford was asked about whether there was any military cooperation with the Russians. He said no. He said it's forbidden, actually, by law at this point, any direct military cooperation with the Russians. All we have is communications with them to, you know, deconflict, to make sure that we're not hitting Russians and Russians are not hitting us in Syria. I'd just be curious what you make of this review process and, you know, how Trump is going to be able to achieve his goal of having a really obvious and devastating defeat of ISIS while, you know, working with Turkey, and for example, which does not yet have the forces to take Raqqa.
I think it's going to be it's a very difficult road to hoe, Barbara. Trump is optimistic, but he probably is overly optimistic. As Linda has said, Syria has bedeviled President Obama, and I think it's likely to bedevil mm-hmm. President Trump. It's interesting, coming back to General McMaster mm-hmm. and the Russians, he is very suspicious of Russian intentions across the board. And so McMaster, I continue to believe, will be good for President Trump. Trump has surrounded himself with generals who, for the most part, think the Russians are bad guys and who are not at all mm-hmm. interested in the kind of let's reason together rhetoric of President Trump.
One more point about Dunford. He listed U.S. adversaries, and they're the 4+1. Let me see if I can get this right. But the first one is Russia, mm-hmm. which is truly a peer competitor because of nuclear weapons and so on. Then he said China. Then he said Iran. Then he said North Korea. And then one non-state actor, Al-Qaeda, Islamic State. So Russia is right up there, mm-hmm. certainly. Another thing that General Dumford did, and McMaster reportedly has done, they don't use the phrase radical Islamic terrorism, which President Trump is very fond of. They talk about violent extremism, which is the old Obama lingo, right. And I think that's also interesting in terms of winning hearts and minds. But I wanted in our remaining minute just, Linda, to mention this piece. It was buried deep in the New York Times, but mm-hmm. The United Nations reported recently that 20 million people are on the brink of famine, including 1.4 million children at imminent risk of death. That's a staggering number. And they're in northern Nigeria, Somalia, Yemen, South Sudan. One of the reasons UN needs $5.6 billion by the end of March to deal with this, and barely 2% of that money is in hand. What can we say about this terrible situation?
I mean, it just, you know, I've been in journalism for 35 years, and this is one of these recurring stories that's so profoundly heartbreaking because there is plenty of food in the world. Famine is a man-made tragedy. And in terms of the amount of money needed to deal with it, I think this might go to the question of whether Donald Trump really has a commitment to the United Nations. We know he's not a big fan of the UN, although he's put somebody respected in there, Nikki Haley, as the U.S. ambassador. So I think this will be yet another test for President Trump. Does he care? I mean, interestingly, he did care about the children, the child immigrants.
Right, the undocumented.
The undocumented children. He said, okay, we'll let them
stay.
Yeah,
but they're in America, so will
That's
he
right.
care
so
about
I'm
these
not,
people over
you know,
there?
But
that's the question.
You know,
yeah.
Donald Trump does have a heart. Maybe that's the point.
Well, that's a great point to close on. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thank you for listening.